a Motorsport Podcast Network production.
Great to have you with me. I'm Aaron Noonan. Welcome along, V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Repco for another week. If you love your motorsport, you have come to the right place. Now, in recent weeks, if you listen to this podcast, you'll know that not long ago, I went on a podcast tour through Queensland and recorded a whole pile of episodes from that trip. Now, this week, it's part one of a two-parter over the next 2 weeks with none other than Mark Larkham. So many of you have asked for Larko on this podcast for a long time, and we finally made it happen. We did this one at his place on the Gold Coast. Yes, I visited the Larko farm. I dodged the cows, and I was wonderfully hosted, actually, and fueled by some great spag bol from Larko's wife, Robin. Larko did nothing in the kitchen that night, which is probably good because that made sure that the spag bol was great. But we sat down and recorded a whole pile of stuff. Now, this week, we have the first part of the pod, and we're going to focus on this part purely on that Mitre 10 Falcon EF, the V8 touring car that he debuted in 1995. Now, it had some unique features, that car. It taught Larko a lot of lessons, and it's a car that we get asked about a lot by fans to this very day. It was one of a kind, and Larko opens up on how it came to be, the theories, the designs, the implementation, as well as how and when that he and his team decided that perhaps it was time to make some changes. Right, buckle up. It's time to start. This is a great episode. I think you'll really enjoy it. It's Larko on the V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Repco. Well, Larko, we've made it. We are here. We are sitting down to talk about one of the most popular topics that we have in V8 Sleuth land, your original Mitre 10 Falcon. Thank you for sitting down, by the way. This is very cozy. We're at the kitchen table, microphone's out, you've got a cup of coffee, we're good to go.
Cup of tea, three beers tea. In. Oh. and just for those listening, and thanks, mate, I'm flattered that people are interested in that car, but just so the people listening know, I'm sitting here in a King G khaki work shirt. Noons has got the V8 Sleuth Tommy Hilfiger shirt on, so things are going pretty well in your department, but let's move along.
I thought I'm going to get kicked out the door. We're rolling in with
mate,
this.
Mate, out here in the bush, we don't know anything.
I'm surprised you even know what this is.
We think it's a flag from a foreign country, you know, lucky you got through the door.
Tiny European nation in the middle of whoop whoop.
But no, but all jokes aside, mate, it staggers me that and flatters me that people are interested in this car because it was a – there's a lot to talk about.
There is. Yeah. There's just a little bit to talk about. So it's sort of hard to know where to start, but a recent podcast that we did a while back with David Hassel, the former editor of Motorsport News, and it came up with him actually, but I wasn't expecting it because the news was broken by the magazine on the front cover with the artwork, and you've got it on your laptop in front of you here, and we can post it on our socials when this pod goes live. That was the first that anybody knew publicly that Formula Brabham driver Mark Larkham is going V8 touring car racing. So that's kind of where it started for the public, but for you it clearly started well before that.
Yeah, well, before we even got to the car, Noons, it was a little fortuitous for myself because Peter Gillitzer was head of Ford Motorsport at the time, you know, well known as did a great job with Ford, a lot of time working with Dick, et cetera. Cito was there. Mm. And things were pretty heavy in terms of content rich and plenty of drivers and teams and cars on the Holden side, and Ford wanted to buffer their ranks, and I got the word of that.
Because they had – it was two and two, two Seaton cars, two Dick cars. That was about it.
Yeah, you know, there was odds and sides running around, but that was really there. So the timing was really good now. But remember that we were quite conflicted at the time. So I'd just done, you know, particularly well in Formula Brabham. You know, won the Formula Ford Championship. So I guess, you know, if you're Ford sitting there, well, who's the next young guy coming through? That's where they look into those junior formula, as still happens today. But it was also the time, remember, when the 2-litre onslaught was happening or potentially happening.
There's a little bit of 2-litre vision from back in the day with your good self commentating some of those races.
With Darrell Eastlake, mate. Oh, Big Dazza, that was a lot of fun. What a character. What a great, great guy. What a character. But what I mean, I haven't got here in front of me, but I dare I say it, I have got artwork prepared that went to Nissan because Greg Siddle, Pee Wee, who we obviously talk about, was pretty well connected with Nissan at the time. We were contemplating two Mitre 10 Nissan Primeras to go into the 2-litre championship. And we're only – we're kind of hedging our bets at the time because we genuinely didn't know in 94 which way this was going to fall. Because 2-litre in the UK was going gangbusters. Mm. Right, it's going to take over the world. Well, obviously the V8 thing sadly is not going to continue. We just need to keep our asses covered over here. So we sort of had a little bit of a foot in both camps, to be honest. But Noons, I can't put my finger on it other than instinct. And I'm so glad I did, just told me that the V8 Ford versus Holden thing was such a powerful part of our culture. And just, you know, is anyone that passionate about a Volvo or a BMW? No chance.
Does anyone remember what a Nissan Primera was? Very few.
So it was basically an instinctive decision. No, shut that down. We're going this way. And it literally was that. And so a discussion happened with Peter Gillitzer and they tucked in behind us with some support, which back in the day, yes, was money and some, you know, and body shells and parts and, you know, Ford Louisville. So we had something to tow our trailer with. And it was really a great time to be part of the Ford family in those early days. So we're off to a good start.
So did you have to convince them to take you into the family or did they go, hey, look, we're down on numbers. Yes, let's do it.
No, it was actually, as I think it was just the timing was good, mate. You know, it was probably one of the easier deals I've done. I think not saying I was anything particularly good, but because I was that young guy at that time, I'd been won that championship, as I said, been combating with Scaife for that whole previous year in Formula Brabham. We went toe-to-toe all year. He won some, I won some. He ultimately won the championship, but he was already a Holden guy. So I guess the next obvious choice was then, well, who's the young guy coming through? So, again, I think it was lucky I was probably that guy at that time. So it was a pretty straightforward, easy, bang, done contract, way we went.
I wish every deal was like that. Jeez.
Oh, don't we wish. Now, you know, I know where we're going to go with this conversation. Would I have done things differently? From that point on, yes, you know, in terms of how we went about this car and built it, it would have been much easier to pick the phone up and ring Dick Johnson or Larry Perkins and just say, can I buy a car?
But the funny thing is, though, mate, we're in an era now where you've got a bunch of teams that buy cars and gear from 888 and Kenny Mac. People have a customer car from a Tickford. In those days, it didn't really happen like that. You could buy a second-hand car from someone, but they weren't a supplier to you like they are now, ongoing and feeding you the updates and the upgrades. And
good point.
It wasn't like that. The category was very different back then. You kind of had to go and do everything yourself, kind of thing. So you probably, although in hindsight you go, oh, we would have had less headaches. Yes, you probably would have, but you might not have been able to get what you think you.
It's a really good. It's a really good pickup, Noons, and I'll tell you why you're right. Is because we'd been doing quite a bit of winning. We never saw – so if you go and buy a car, obviously you're literally buying what back then was a privateer car. Mm. It was a second-hand car with second-hand bits with redundant technology typically that, hey, see you later, thanks very much.
There's a reason why it was let out the door.
And without sounding like a smart ass, because I'm not, and we knew we had a big mountain to climb, it just didn't even enter my brain at all that we're going to go and buy some – we're not privateers. You know, we're coming out of where we've just been successfully and we're going into this game and we want to be successful. And the only way we're going to do that is row our own boat. Mm. And then after that, I think I made a lot of decisions that weren't particularly right in terms of making that boat as good as it could have been, but they were great, you know, great learnings, great learnings.
What was the influence – is it because you had come from the open wheeler thing that you built it and conceived it and designed it and developed it the way you did? Was it purely because you went, that's what we know? Or did you look at what was going on in V8s and go, yeah, I reckon we can do better than this? Which of the things was the thing that made you go down the path that you went down? Because clearly at some point you made the decision to go that way. So what made you go that way?
A little bit of both. Without doubt, the first point, you're right. That was the primary thing. Everyone I was surrounded by, everyone, were open wheeler people. Mm. Like we'd done several years of it. You know, we'd been running Raynards, which were ex-Formula 3000 cars. You know, I'd worked with Bruce Carey, Dave Moore, Elwyn Bickley. I'd done some work with Harry Galloway. I mean, these were supreme, highly intelligent, highly skilled open wheeler craftsman that built cars, designed parts, and did them. So Greg Siddle, Sam Michael, who you know, I'd just been completely surrounded and in that world. And obviously, I had deep ambition to go to Europe, which I tried. I couldn't raise the funds to do what I wanted to do over there. Came home, and we were so lucky to have this category here in this country to come back to. So everything in our DNA, our culture, every morning we got up, it only had to do with open wheelers, which were light, low center of gravity, good aerodynamics, exotic, lightweight materials put in the right place, building things more by theory and minimum size for maximum loads, or a bit more like building an aircraft, I guess. So I guess in one way you could say we didn't know any better, but it's more we just didn't know any other way. So that's the first point. The second point then is we looked at the touring car racing and we really knew nothing about it. And in hindsight now, I mean, I look at them and, you know, we can talk about some of the detail of the car, but from an open wheeler point of view, I looked at a touring car because I hadn't been taking much notice on them because I was going to Europe. Mm. You know, I only had interest in Formula One. I could have told you everything about every car in the pit lane in Europe in Formula 3000, F3, Formula 4, 2000, F1 at that time. I just was not looking at touring cars. And then when we came back and think, okay, we're going to go touring car racing, we're going to build a car, we'll build our own car. For example, I couldn't understand why would the driver sit there? Why would he sit where you sit kind of in a road-going car? There's no rule stopping you from moving it centralised and moving it way back in the car to centralise the weight and then put him down lower on the floor. And that wasn't to say the guys that were building cars up there didn't know what they were doing. We looked at that logically and thought, why wouldn't you do that differently? Why wouldn't you move? Okay, there's some implications there in terms of steering column and pedals and what have you. So we kind of applied that theory to many parts on the car. And Steve Dewhurst, who, again, open wheeler guy, great engine guy, one of the most intelligent guys I've ever come across in my life, and, mate, pretty well everyone I meet is more intelligent than I am, but he's right up there at the top of the pile. Just a high Steve should be in F1. He's that sort of guy. So he was really the brains behind most of the design of the car. Then people like Elwin Bickley and Dave Moore were responsible for the construction of all the componentry for that design. Remember, we made everything. Mm. Right, everything.
Nothing off the shelf. No, everything. Go and buy that to just get us by
everything.
That
bit. You know, and that was a time when Ronnie Harrop was making beautiful bits that you could have readily bought off the shelf. But we'd look at a Ronnie Harrop front upright, beautifully made. But you know, again, from what we knew about how open wheelers did it and the loads and the theory, wow, we can make this, fabricate it, laser cut some stuff, make it much smaller, much lighter, much more nimble. And again, that was applied to everything on the car. And in practice and in theory, if you need to put 400 kilos of load, intentional shear, across three bolts, three fasteners, well, when you do the math on it, they can be 1032 fasteners, for example. So that's exactly what we did. But where we went wrong is that in theory we put a car on the ground that theoretically was ready to accept all the loads, the downforce, the horsepower, the drive, the shear loads, the tensions in loads in tension, all those things. But when you put it into practice in the real world, right, which we found out really quickly, you know, banging wheels with Wayne Gardner, banging off curbs at Oran Park, you know, all of those things that are running behind cars in dirty, hot air, the car just failed and failed and failed. And more so than its failure, it was the servicing. We would have needed a team of 100 people to keep the servicing schedule up to it, to keep all those tiny little bearings and those tiny little fasteners and those tiny little shims in place that made it what it was. So that was the issue right there. So Noons, and it's important to me that I acknowledge, and never did we think we never looked at the touring car guys that were doing, oh, we can do it better than them. They were doing a great job. We just didn't know another way and we did it the way we knew it. And I think back then we probably didn't have enough regard for the toughness and the volatility that was touring car racing. and we didn't have enough regard for what Larry Perkins, for example, has enormous regard for, the mountain.
Mm.
We didn't build a car to go to Bathurst. You know, just when we're building the car, it just wasn't big on our radar. Where look at the way he's done it for 30 years. You know, basically builds a car to go to Bathurst and races it in the other races during the year.
When Larry got calendars for Christmas, there was only 1 month.
That's right.
There was not 12. It was October and that was it. There was nothing else in the calendar.
Every lap in under a minute. Every move made to matter. Every decision impacting the outcome of the race. Supercars in Perth. Every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars. Unforgettable.
So we know you so much now for being based up on the coast in Queensland, but at this time, this is Sydney. This is a Sydney car team effort. Where was it based? How did that all come together?
So we had a leased factory around at Smithfield, nice industrial area. In fact, Crompo, Wally Story, the Coca-Cola Commodores, Wayne Gardner were only about a kilometre away. And it was an interesting time because at that time, in fact, we're a little bit ahead of them in setting up out in that place. It was almost like we had the Sydney market to ourselves because all the teams were either in Melbourne or Queensland.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was Lansvale.
That's what it's like now. There's no one really in Sydney of a top tier. There's some, you know, some support category teams and stuff like that, but not main game supercars, V8s.
Ain't it bizarre? Tell me why. I still can't work it out. And, you know, and it was a really good circumstance commercially because we had this, you know, captured market, the Sydney, and it's metropolitan, and there was Steve Reed and Trevor Ashby.
Lansvale boys. Yep.
And then the Coke boys came along later. So that was pretty cool. And then pretty well all the people I'd been involved with in open wheelers literally just carried over into the team. And then there was some other brilliant people. You know, Pete Smith, who sadly we lost last year. He used to run the Ducati race team. He was up the road from me. Again, highly intelligent, brilliant designer, brilliant machinist, could look at something, visualise it, go make it. And that happened with a lot of parts on that car. Drawings for everything, but a lot of it was organic and took visualisation, creativity. How can we do it better, stiffer, lighter, stronger? Dave Moore, I can't speak enough about Dave Moore, Moore Engineering, built the Moore race car, successful Formula Fords. Elwyn Bickley built the Elwyn race car, successful Formula Fords.
Well, you didn't build the Larkham race car?
Yeah, well,
everyone else built one after
Steve Dewhurst. You know, Steve Dewhurst, if I remember correctly, I think Steve used to work in Judd, as in
Formula One engines.
And Steve's a guy that could have gone all the way in that capacity. I mean,
so how big's this team? How many people have you got there?
Oh, mate, I'm guessing.
It's not massive. No,
maybe 12.
Yeah, maybe 12.
Pete Wallace, who I still have a lot to do with Pete today. He works in Super. He's doing my Formula Ford engine now that I'm restoring. I love Pete. So Pete was there. Adam Perry, who's been with me most of my racing life, my best man at my wedding. We played footy together at school, went to school together, did the girls thing together. Well, not together, okay? Had girlfriends. Let's just girlfriends at school.
I knew what you meant.
We did everything together. Played in a band together.
What did you play in the band though?
Drums and sang. Can you believe it?
Could you sing?
No, I wouldn't profess that I could sing.
Right,
no.
So, you were just less worse than the rest of them.
We had a weekly gig noons at a place called the Three Sisters. It was a restaurant in town at Griffith. I can't remember. We might have got $180 or something for a Saturday night, but it was just a great time in our lives. And so Adam and I, right to this day, remain best mates. So he was with me the whole way through my career in one capacity or another. So it was a great. You know, I often think if you could do it differently, would you do it differently? And before this conversation ends, I just want to describe a few of the parts, if we can get to that, because these guys deserve credit. There was some really cool stuff on that car. But for me personally, it was great learnings because it's very, very hard in motorsport to put together a budget to have a year, and we had Mitre 10 and support from Ford and Yokohama sponsorship.
Karcher.
We had some great brands.
I remember I entered the Karcher Magic Moments competition on Channel 7 back in the day. Do you remember that?
How did you go?
I didn't win it. I didn't get no Karcher guff. I didn't get the shed. I didn't get anything. I just remember you doing the ta-da, here it is with your arm stretched out of here's what you could win, ta-da, and I didn't win it.
Well, you go back and look at the car, you'll see there's quite a few, as there was over the next 5 or 6 years, quite a few associate brands to Mitre 10, and that came out of when, I mean, I could sit here and speak for an hour about the Mitre 10 sponsorship story. It's a good one, but in short, they started with a small amount of money because I said, well, I'll put number 10 on my car. This is when I was doing Formula Brabham. So I wasn't actually giving away any real estate on the car. I said, I'll change my name to number 10.
Because you've got to have a number anyway.
I've got to have a number anyway. Yeah, and then we'll put a little mitre above it. We'll put it in your font. And then if you send a check to $500 to Cams back in the day, you're allowed to use the non-Helvetica font on your race car. So what they used to do at Cams, I'm sure, is they'd go and buy carrots, bags of carrots with that $500, right? Because the timekeepers then could see the number even though it was a different font. And I've never seen a rabbit wearing glasses, right? So I could never understand how the $500 meant that you could use another font. But anyway, be that as it may, you could. So if you look at my 92 Formula Brabham, you'll see it's just literally Mitre 10 where the numbers are, the end plates and the nose. And that's kind of how it started. But then I went to, I got about 43 of their suppliers to put in a little bit of money each, which together made up a lot of money. So that was enough to fund my Formula Brabham season. So a lot of those managed to step up and carry on into the touring car thing. So sorry, mate, I went off track there a little bit with the sponsorship, but it was the point being it's hard to get sponsorship for any given year in motorsport. And we had a budget. And yes, if I could wind the clock back and do it differently, of course you would. But then I think, well, maybe I wouldn't, because I learned so much in that year or two about engineering of a race car, what worked and what didn't. Most of all, excuse me, I learned about people, people management. I don't blame, I take full responsibility for the failures of that car because I gave a lot of people free rein. And every one of them was entirely right to grab that free rein and the money I was giving them to make that part, design that part, engineer that part. That's their job. And I got right behind them to do it. And so they were good life lessons, mate, really good life lessons.
And it's the pathway of where you've ended up. So if you didn't do that, where does your pathway end up? Who knows? That's the thing of it.
It's a funny thing. You know, I make no mistake. For many years, I looked on with envy at someone like Russell Ingall. So Russ and I battled hard in Formula Ford together and he went the driver route. And I went the team owner slash driver route. Now, if you go back to that period, you know, Glenn Seaton, Mark Scaife, Brad Jones, you know, Crompo was sort of a managing driver. You know, they were all more roles than just driving. So I look on with envy of guys like Russell Ingall who could then sustain a career as being a driver. And that was kind of very much the start of it because teams back then evolved from owners like Dick Johnson, you know,
Larry Perkins,
being owner drivers, right? Yep. Which isn't the case anymore,
no.
Which is a distinct example of how the game has changed and moved on. So I chose back then to go the other route and yeah, maybe if I'd put the flag out, there might have been some other driving opportunities out there, but that's never really been the thing for me. And if I reflect now 30 years on or whatever, I think it probably suited my future career to do what we did and go where we went, and I learnt the lessons that I need to learn, fiscal responsibility with the budget, you know, and all of those sorts of things that
it all comes into effect later on. And I'm sure there's things you learnt in 95, 96, 94 period that you used in your racing further, used in your business, you used in all the other stuff that you do in your world to this day.
Life.
Yeah.
I mean, asking people, I mean, those guys, what they put in was phenomenal. I mean, everyone was paid, but the hours that had to go into that car, because remember, we built it in 94 for the start of the 95 season. As we approached the first race, it was clear and we were doing big hours, big, big hours.
Well, before we started this chat, you commented that the video clip from Channel 7's telecast covering the launch is on YouTube somewhere. You can actually find it. And for the launch of Mitre 10 Racing and the V8 touring car, the car that's in all the photos ain't the touring car. It's the show car with really dark windows so no one can see that it's the show car.
Exactly. We pulled the cover off the show car and we did with that day. We tinted the windows that dark so you couldn't see it. You know, because it was just, you know, there was a bunch of, you know, it was great. Ford Australia came up from Melbourne. 7 were there. They put it live to TV. All the press were there. Motorsport Newswear to do this piece on it. So that was just fabulous. And, again, it was very flattering to have that interest in this team, but we just couldn't get the car finished in time. So we did display it.
There's a blue shell over in the corner.
With an engine.
Oh, that's the race car.
A dummy block in it, yeah. But there was a lot going on. So anyway, we missed the first round, which I think was Simmons from memory.
95 first round was Sand. Oh, so there was the triple challenge was a thing back then. That was the last year of that at Eastern Creek. So you missed that.
Yep.
Scafie was busy throwing himself at a concrete block and scoring himself a headache and a holiday from round one at Sandown, round two in Tassie, round three was the sprint round at Bathurst.
Which is where we went first. We couldn't have picked a worse place to take a car. That was built with 10,000 new bits on it, right? So we didn't – when we went there and Warwick Rookland co-drove with me, right? Remember that year?
Later on in the year for the endurance race.
Oh, the endurance race. Sorry, the sprint race. So they're two different things. The sprint race – so I've got a vision of Warwick's eyeballs the first time he pulled into the pit lane after driving that car, right?
Wide, just a little wide.
Just wide, yeah. Right? So we go to Bathurst. It had no anti-roll bars on it. Got those finished. It was pretty scary to drive because we just had commercial obligations. We had to get there and the car wasn't finished enough. And, you know, again, long story short, the front uprights on this car were aluminium spindles, which I've never ever seen since.
Maybe for reason.
The wheel nuts are the same size as – exact same size. I showed Campbell Little just recently as the wheel nuts they're just about to put on the Gen 3 car, which are tiny. And I know Jeremy Moore, I think, has designed them. They've come from maybe sports cars in Europe. So the flex we got in these uprights and spindles was quite extraordinary. So they flex that much that, of course, the caliper flexes – the disc brake flexes, the pads get pushed back, they push the pistons back, so you end up with a long brake pedal, right? Now, we can talk later about it's got the carbon fibre seat capsule in it, right?
Which you showed me before we sat down. You've still
kept
got
that bit.
The seat capsule in the shed here.
Yeah, which is kind of a cool part. And it had all the pedals and master cylinders and everything built into the capsule, right?
So audio medium, a little difficult, we can't just show it. But there's probably a period photo of the time we might be able to wheel out.
Yep.
But rather than Dick Johnson's Falcons, Larry Perkins Commodores, HRT Commodore, it was the seat, traditional seat steering wheel dash. Whereas remember that Erebus went down this pathway with their supercars in the Merck era, sort of similar type scenario.
As did Merck in DDM.
The E-cell capsule where you brought that. So it was all enclosed. It was not just a seat. It was a bit of everything. You were almost like your little single-seater monocoque plonked inside the car.
Yeah, which, again, just seemed logical to us because I didn't want to sit up straight. I wanted to lay down a little bit more like in an open wheeler to get weight down lower. So we thought, well, and then we could cut into the centre hump. There's a rule you can only go so far, but we weren't as far as we could go so that we were way centralised. There was a big gap, like a supercar now. Exactly like a Gen 3. We had that big gap back then because I was worried about my own safety from door intrusion, side intrusion, but just to get the weight centralised. Then we had a big, long steering column and we went way back as far as we could because it seemed, well, why are we forward? The only reason we're forward is because the pedal box is up there in the footwell, right? Well, how about we put the pedals on the capsule, then we'll take the capsule all the way back. And that's exactly what we did. So we had
the theory's good. The theory is really
well,
good.
Well, that bit of it actually worked pretty well, except the cable off the throttle pedal went around behind the – you couldn't see it. This is all inside the – went behind the brake pedal. And I go back to those – I go to Bathurst and go up the hill through turn one, over the sort of the rise, turn two into Griffin's Air. It's bumpy. Lot of load and the spindles flex a lot. So I'd get up heading to BP cutting, go for the brake pedal. The brake pedal was nearly gone. It was really long. And then just when it got to nearly, I won't say the floor, but a long way down, it'd pick up the throttle cable, wouldn't it? And pull on. So just when you're running out of brakes, it'd pick up the throttle cable and give you a bit of throttle.
Oh.
Wow, how cool is that?
No, not cool. Not cool.
So that was... That was scary. That was scary. And not having roll bars. But anyway, we made an appearance there and started to identify immediately, you know, some of the issues. And Noons, it wasn't – once that wasn't long, we battled much of that year out and then we started to realise the value in a Ron Harrop front upright, a Ron Harrop anti-roll bar system, a Ron Harrop diff. And we just started to migrate to put a lot of those bits back into that car to put the reliability into it.
Do you know how to find the right oil for your car? Now you can find out quickly and easily online, thanks to Castrol's Rego to Oil tool. Simply type in your Rego, select your state, and within seconds you'll know the best Castrol products to unlock the edge of performance in your car. So what's your car best suited to? Just search Rego, the number 2, and oil, and find out.
But again, you know, mate, that seat. I remember Adam Perry and I did it with a chunk of foam in my backyard. And then Greg, our composites guy, he grabbed that and did his magic with it and made this beautiful carbon fiber seat. We bolted the seat to the cage, which wasn't happening back then, right? Everyone was bolting it down through the floor, strengthening and all the rest of it, but we bolted to the cage. Then we made a pretty sophisticated steering column with a collapsible component to it. But, mate, there is so many. Can I just trot off a couple of the
Absolutely. The
big ones? You know, if you start at the front of the car, again, from a heating and a thermal capacity point of view, when you did the math, if you did the appropriate ducting, they didn't need the great big radiator that everyone was using. Now, in reality, they did because when you run them in traffic and full of leaves and, you know, all the rest of the stuff and all the other circumstances that you don't think of, but in theory, they didn't. So I remember we started with actually basically the core of a road going, it was an aluminium. I think it was a Commodore, might have been a Commodore radiator core, but we fully ducted it, right? And the reason we could fully duct, so we made all this ducting that came in from the front, encapsulated the whole radiator, then behind the radiator, fully ducted this beautiful slipstream ducting that went down under the engine, and then our front cross member and a lot of our front components underneath were made out of aero tube, like F1 were making wishbones out of at the time. I got it from the UK. It was horrendously expensive. So the airflow could go through that aero tube. If you imagine a cross member with all this aero tube, like a wing foil shaped tube, right? So it could flow through there. So the whole thing was kind of ducted. And a lot of the other stuff underneath the car was gone because we had a very sophisticated sumping system on it, and then bolted to the bottom of that was another beautiful milled plate that had a front anti-roll bar, which at the time everyone was using a great big chunk of tube, 4 foot long across the car there, bolted to the chassis rails with two big mother blades coming off it, right? Worked beautifully. But again, we looked and thought, geez, that's a big monstrosity of a roll bar. We've come from anti-roll bars on open wheels, which
finite,
are small, finite, nice.
Yeah.
So I've kept a couple of them because they're beautifully made, beautifully designed by the boys. They're about 300 mil long, and they actually, they sat in a bearing that was bolted literally underneath the sump of the engine, and it went longitudinally along the car, this little bladed device. Then it had two pull rods that went outboard to the left and right front suspension, to rockers, long before anyone was using rockers on anti-roll bars, onto our suspension. So the anti-roll bar rate, which is something we work a lot on now, as the wheel deflects, you want a really nice rate there, we optimised that, you know, by doing that and made a really lightweight, optimised anti-roll bar system. So, you know, for me that was a real nicety, but that was let down because the uprights that we made were very lightweight, very small bearings, very sophisticated. But as I explained earlier, you know, they just weren't up to the task. So a lot of that front area of the car didn't work. But we had things like the alternator.
I remember this.
Yeah, the alternator on the tail shaft. Because what just made no sense. Why would you want to rev the engine as the engine goes up to 7.5 RPM and then comes back down as you change gear and then revs back up to 7? Why would you want to drag the alternator up and down, up and down, up and down? It's just a drag on the engine like that. Wouldn't it be smarter having the alternator run at road speed, just constant? So we mounted the alternator down underneath the car, get the lower centre of gravity again, and it ran off the – and we also did the same with the power steering pump. So we thought, why hang the power steering pump off an engine that's trying to rev up and down really quickly? Let's let the thing rev. So we put both those down on the tail shaft, which was a multi-piece tail shaft rather than a one-piece tail shaft. So this is getting really complex now.
This is getting really complex and really expensive as well.
There you go, right? So now, again, they both work great in theory, having the power steer down there and the alternator. But again, mate, it's when you go out and put it into the practical world that it failed, because two things happened. Back in the day when you start up, and I remember it happened at Lakeside, so you put your fuel pumps on and all your pumps, and it's a rainy day, and you got your demister on and you got everything going, but the alternator's sitting there not doing anything because it's connected to the tail shaft, not rotating.
It's not moving.
It's not charging, right? It's not charging. And you got a battery then, and so you're powering injectors and a Motec ECU and all this. So there's enormous drain on the system. And by the time you dummy up in the dummy grid and then waltz around and then do a warm-up lap, by the time you're in, the battery's nearly flat, right? So that was problem number one. Real-world practice, you know, we missed that bit. The power steer sounds really good. Except when you got in a really big, say, in the wet, big opposite lock slide, right, where the rear wheels are nearly stalled, right? Now the power steering, right, when you need it most, it's not spinning as fast. So that became problematic in awkward times. So, again, great concepts in theory. And, in fact, that we made a three-piece tail shaft and the centre section was an oil pump. We made our own oil pump. Now, we never got that completed. I think I've still got it out there. Again, a beautiful, beautiful piece of engineering. For all the same reasons. But you'd think if you just could have developed all this stuff a little bit further, a little bit more refined in a practical sense, I mean, they're good ideas, lower centre of gravity, you know, taking drain off the engine. But they're just a couple of the roll cage. Mate, I imported, I can't remember how much, mate, from Britain, carbon manganese tube, right?
So, sounds expensive, probably was expensive.
And we used that because that was the very latest and greatest things in torsional and structural rigidity and all the rest of it. They were using it in modern racing push bike frames and these sorts of things. And I remember the main roll hoop had to be cams specified in terms of thickness and its structural integrity, but everything else you're free. Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you most of the rest of the roll cage in that car we cut with tin snips. Right, so the ends to match the engines, not the tin snips. Right, I can't remember. Oh, geez, I wish I could. It was thin wall, but it was super strong and thin wall. And if you go back, maybe I can. I've got a great photo I can give you of the cage. We did a lot of, again, a long time before people did. We did finite element analysis of the roll cage. We also build stick models of it. We did all this stuff to make sure, and it's a pretty cool cage design, I've got to say, in terms of allowed us to use that light tube but still have the torsional rigidity.
In this process, is computer design involved here at all, or are we still manual? We're still analog.
Everything was on a drawing board.
Yeah.
Everything. Steve Dewhurst spent so much time on that drawing board. And again, mate, we made everything. So we made our front uprights, we made our front cross member, we made all our radiator system, we made the tail shaft, we made the whole diff housing, the axles, everything. Our diff housing. So we looked at the diff housing and thought, oh, gee, that's that big hemisphere. It weighs a ton. It's up high. So we actually put camber into the diff housing. So the hemisphere was down low.
And the rest was out.
And what we also then did, because of torsional twist and the way it all works in there, we actually made our axles, let me get this right, the axles, the differential is offset. The differential in our thing was offset so we could get, because you've got to shorten a long axle, which means the torsional forces out to the wheels are different side to side. We wanted equal length axles. So we had our hemisphere offset to allow for the crown wheel and pinion in there to have equal length, to be offset, to have equal length axles, right? More theory, right? Yeah. So then, because we have this camber built into and I can give you a photo of the diff, we had to work out how to do camber out at the wedge. So we had to design our own wedge system and all the rest to be able to change camber. And we used inside that diff housing in at the hemisphere and outboard these things, which Sam Michael helped me find. He was in Formula One at the time by then. Tripod Williams were using them. They're called a tripod joint. So we had these weird ass joints in there to, you know, again, at a time when everyone had that, you know, Ronnie Harrop and Larry they had this bit completely sorted and we were reinventing it and we didn't need to, but we did. And again, in theory, so we had all this weight down low, we had a nice lightweight fabricated diff housing. Beautiful. But those tripod joints were just never made to run in there like that, and we just, you know, they were just a servicing nightmare.
So for all these bits that you're developing, that you're creating, that you're dreaming up, drawing, creating, having the theory, you know, the bit that we haven't talked about yet that's kind of crucial in any race car, engine. Of all of the things that you had the theory on that it didn't quite go right, or oh, that didn't work out how we thought, did you have the motor bit right? Or yeah, was that kind of another learning curve of all of that?
Yeah, the engine is interesting. Peter, I worked with Peter Malloy back then. So, I mean, Steve Dewhurst did a lot of the initial stuff. Peter Wallace did a lot of stuff. Peter Malloy did stuff for me, and we lost Peter not that long ago. And I remember we were around, I think, 525, 540 horsepower back then.
So how far off the money are you? Or thereabouts?
Yeah, I don't think. Oh, gee, mate, I remember. They might have been 570 or something back then. We weren't right there, but that certainly was not our biggest issue. Absolutely
you,
was.
You had more stuff going on than your motor.
No, well, people like Pete Wallace and Dewhurst were good engine guys. You know, they were highly competent. And it's a shame we actually never got to finish the really cool stuff in the engine. Steve was working on an inlet system that was integral to the head that was just magnificent. But again, it was one of the sad parts of this whole process because we didn't have enough staff. And again, that was badly managed by me. I should have seen all this coming. There was a lot of projects we just had to cull. So, you know, at the 11th hour, we actually end up going and buying Ronnie Harrop butterflies for our engine that got us going, you know, and we end up doing that with a few things, not a lot. I mean, the wheels is another classic example. Again, everything we knew about suspension design in an open wheel car, or when you're designing a race car like people like Bickley and Dave Moore had, is optimizing motion ratios and these things. So we just designed the suspension to absolutely optimize that, to have the suspension points out where exactly where they needed to be, where the dampers connected, where the anti-roll bar, right out as far as we could. So we had most mechanical advantage over those points, right? That then meant we had to design our own wheel. So we got Dymag in the UK to make wheels.
So this is getting out of control here, mate. This is out of control. Everybody else goes and gets the wheels that everyone else
Speedline
uses pretty much.
Yeah.
Techno Magnesio back in the day as well. But no, not Larko and his brothers.
Yeah.
Oh, no. We're going to go to Dymag in the UK and go and get a whole pile made just for us.
Yep. But the point that rim attached to our hub and where our hub sat, the center line of our, was out further than anyone. And that's good practice. That's good practice. But again, all of that just fell down because they made a wheel and they made it as light as they possibly could. And when we brought it out here, again, they'd never put a Yokohama supercar tire or Group A tire on it. It was a 5-spoke tire and the bead of the Yokohama tire was just, back then it was a very heavy bead and it actually flattened. Just subtly, but enough to be a drama.
Enough that you couldn't really.
We had to keep. Well, it was just another job we had to do. After every event, we had to re-roll our wheels to
the
try and.
Servicing take list the for this car must have been like a 900-page exercise book.
Well, it burnt people out, you know, and it just got hard. And that's when we started to unwind and backtrack. We just had to. I mean, and
well,
it was.
When did you twig? Oh, we've got too far here.
Probably a couple of events in, because the first couple of events you sort of think, you know, we're still in
teething
New Hampshire, we're teething,
yeah,
blah, blah, blah. But it was just the sheer servicing of it. You know, every time we ran the car, we had to pack this three-piece tail shaft. We had to pack these little shims in the bearings every time we ran it. You know, it's hard enough, mate. It's hard enough balancing a one-piece tail shaft. You know, so there was just lots of little things. But now, having said that, you know, the feels, everyone was kind of buying a common old fuel cell and bottling in a common place. So we thought, no, we can do it. So we redesigned how the pumps worked in there and where we got the fuel cell built overseas to optimise where it sat in the car, forward, low, all of the rest of it. So all of those things were really nice. And I remember the day we finished the car and went to race it, we bolted 120 kilograms of lead on the rear floor. That's how much underweight it was. And that is phenomenal.
That's
a long way. But it's meaningless because at the end of the day, I would have rather we used that 120 kilos now in making those 1032 screws holding the front clevises on to hold the front wishbone into quarter-inch bolts and everything else in the car like that. And, again, that's not a reflection because I have nothing but credit for the guys that designed the stuff on that car. I gave them the freedoms to do it, and they did it theoretically. We fell short because we did not build a car for practical use, and we failed pretty dismally on that front.
So at this point, with all of these things, all this stuff that you've designed, all of this stuff that you've had just for you, not off the shelf, not something that's already made for the other cars in the field, have you blown the budget here? Has this gone way above and over what money that you've got here, or have you somehow managed to bring this in somewhere near what you actually had in your sponsorship money for that year? I can't imagine that you could have with all this stuff.
Yeah, no, we chewed it up, and I can't remember the number exactly back then. You know, we didn't have a big budget, but a lot of people worked a lot of overtime for me, which was great. And look, if I'm brutally honest, I think a lot of us were fed by the passion of being able to, because we're, you know, not me, but the guys, the engineering types, and they loved the challenge of, you know, looking at everything and thinking, well, how do we do this, you know, how do we do this better, lighter, stronger from an engineering point of view, which each, if I got every component of this car and sat on a table and brought all the best engineers in the business, I reckon you look at each one individually and go, magnificent.
Mm.
But collectively, to go out and race, and as I say, to bang curbs, hot days, cold days, wet weather, fogged windscreens, you know, Russell Ingall belting you around, whatever it might be, all of those things meant that the car just did not work in a practical sense. And I had so much admiration very quickly for what others in the category, you know, the Larrys and the Dicks, for example, the HRTs, had learned over so many years about what did work in the category. And it must have been hard for a lot of their engineers sometimes to ignore some of the things that you obviously would have loved to have done, but knew in practice they probably just couldn't have worked properly. Now, I'm flattered, Noons, that many years, and I'm flattered not because of anything I did, but because of the nice work that some of my engineers did, that many of the things we did popped up in supercars many years later. So that's kind of, but by then developed in a way that they could work alongside, you know, other components. You know, for example, I think our front suspension geometry and our anti-roll bar system was magnificent. But unfortunately, it was brought down because it was just part of all the other stuff in there that didn't work. So probably mid-season we started to backtrack pretty quickly, and we're so lucky to have the Ron Harrops of the world that had a lot of the stuff off the shelf, you know, Modeners and Perkins, and there was bits and pieces around at the time that got us by, but wasn't very long after that I thought, hallelujah, Stone Brothers are my saviour.
I'll be there in a minute. Do you remember the reaction of the other teams in the touring car at the time? What's this Larkin bloke on?
The big chat, seriously. Because a lot of people didn't get to see what was sort of under the covers, but there was a lot of chat about where I was sitting in the car.
From a point of view of?
Central and backwards.
But their talk was that you shouldn't be allowed to do that from
no,
a rule
not
perspective?
At all. No, they
or
just
was
heard
the case
about
of you're out there, that's
and,
weird.
Why and Noons, there's, I distinctly remember the first time I pulled out of the garage and went along the pit lane at Bathurst. I remember people walking out onto the apron so they could sight the car from straight on to see where my head was in the cockpit.
Mm.
That was – I absolutely remember that.
So was all this stuff kept secret? Were you like – because this was unique, or were you so busy just doing it that there wasn't this whole – because race teams have that thing. They've got a thing. A lot of them got that thing. Don't tell anyone. No. We're working on something. We're doing something different.
We weren't promoting it, but we weren't anal about it because, I mean, all of it was unproven and, you know, and I think there was, you know, I could probably sense there was probably a bit of attitude out there, you know, let him fail because, you know.
He thinks he knows better.
Like to say that. It's not so much – we thought we knew how to do it differently and we were wrong. So, you know, I don't blame anyone for thinking, you know, let these guys go and they'll trip over and eventually they'll come around and have to build a car like we all build them, which, you know, I can't tell you how refreshing it was those first, you know, year or two at Stone Brothers there, being able to focus on, you know, driving and setup, not car reliability, and it was just a whole different dynamic. And I was a little bit frustrated then because you sort of think, gee, did I miss that window in my career? Because I, you know, personally, it was a bit of a, it was a tough couple of years trying to find the money. And you said the point earlier, do we use up all our budget? Like, you know, I mean, I had to bring my sponsors very, very close to me and really buddy up and partner with them on this journey and make them understand what we're trying to do here. And as it failed, try to let them understand why it failed. And to their credit, they stayed on board for the journey. You know, about 1,000 k's north to Stone Post.
So that car ran two seasons, 1995, missed the first few rounds, rest of the Touring Car Championship, Sandown Bathurst, Brock Classic at Calder, I'm pretty sure you did that.
There you go, yeah.
Adelaide Grand Prix, the last Adelaide Grand Prix, I can't remember off the top of my head. You were there, you weren't there, I can't remember. Because in those days.
Yeah, would have been.
Yeah, probably would. You were a level one. Well, you weren't in a level one. Outside,
yeah. We did all the races, we could.
And then 96 was the second year of that car. And things were more reliable. You were like, in that first year, there were non-starts, there were non-finishes, there was non-this, there was not much going on. But then the second year, it actually. You actually started to get results. Like you were finishing races and you were, you know, at least because you'd Harrapized and you'd modernized and you'd Perkinsized and you actually had something that you could actually race and you could actually compete in.
Yep, absolutely. And, which made the decision all the much harder to pack up shop and literally go to Stone Brothers because, you know, that whole journey, those couple of years was about that car.
Mm.
And, you know, I've kept just a selection of parts off that car just for memory's sake, and I've got some good photos that, you know, I'm happy to share with you. But, yeah, we did get a bit of running done in that second year but only for those reasons because we did put – and, again, I just remember I was so thirsty then. You know, the thirst I had for Harrop parts was just incredible because I just wanted to go racing. You'd realise the error of your ways. You're in this circumstance where you've got a facility, people, staff, sponsorship commitments, races to go to, a car that you're changing quickly. I was just so thirsty. Yeah, I've got to be honest, I was over it.
Mm.
I just wanted to go racing because at the end of the day, Noons, you get into – well, the reason I got in racing because I love driving the race car. Mm. I wanted to be competitive. I wanted to win. You know, so I didn't do it because I wanted to be involved in an engineering thesis. I just thought of that as a conduit to get to
the good bit.
To be part of a great team that built great cars and go and be successful both driving and running that team. But, you know, it was made some wrong decisions.
Do you remember that – was it Malwar that there was a big shunt? That you got involved in a big shunt with – was it Romano?
Was it Richo or Romano?
I think it was Romano. The pack leader car.
Yeah, I spun or something. I got T-boned or something like that.
Like it was a big whack.
Yeah, I got a photo of that.
Mm. Yeah. You got a photo of everything.
Yeah,
I think you're the only race team in the period that took all these photos of stuff.
Yeah, we seem to always have a photographer around. Well, the guy that was associated with Mitre 10 actually was a photographer, so he went to all the events. So, yeah, we got a pretty good photo record of a lot of these things. So, and look, that was the other thing. Whenever there was an incident with the car, everything was bespoke. Everything was one-off, so hard to repair. So it made it was a tough time, great learnings. Shit, can we talk about something else? It's all flooding back.
Well, the ironic thing is, so its racing career started at Bathurst and ended at Bathurst because in 96, Cam McConville came and co-drove with you. Warwick Brooklyn had done the Enduros the previous year. And then I think Sandown, the car to start from the pit lane for a reason. And at Bathurst it was wet, remembering the early laps there. And I think it was three laps in and it was out on Conrod Strait in a off the road in the wall.
Oh, was and that car?
Yeah.
So one year rolls into the next, yeah.
It's sort of like two or three laps or whatever it was. That's it. That is the end of its racing career.
And I thought that was the end of me just quickly on that incident.
Because it's not on TV. There's no vision of that crash.
So that was – it was probably about lap three, right? Remember the start of the race was bucketed down. Mm. So we're under safety car right at the start of the race. We're going down Conrod and they hadn't put the safety car board out. We're going down Conrod flat out. Now, for those of you that haven't driven Bathurst, when you're going down Conrod in the wet, you're still probably, you know, like you're doing 300 Ks nearly in the dry, and back then it wasn't much different. In the wet, you're probably, I'm guessing, probably still doing 270. You know, it's not like you drop off a whole bunch of speed. And the problem is you literally, particularly that early in the race with all the traffic in front of you and behind you, you cannot see 10 metres past the front of your body. And I mean that very sincerely. I don't exaggerate. You literally can't see, right?
We're sitting at a kitchen table that's, 2.5 metres long. Yeah. You probably couldn't see much further than that half the time.
That's serious, mate. And so it's – and I don't mind saying it's frightening. It's a frightening experience.
There's no way that it's not.
But you've got to be brave because you've got to keep your foot buried into the throttle because you know if you come off the throttle behind you, you know the guy behind you can't see you either. So you've just got to maintain speed. And you're sort of half guessing, geez, when we get to the chase, I hope I can kind of half make out where we are on the road. Anyway, safety car boards come out. Richo, who was in front of me, buttoned off, so he got to see them.
Steve Richards.
Steve Richards. Yep. I didn't see anything until I was in his boot, right? So then that spun me around backwards. This was the scary bit. So I'm going backwards now at 200 and something kilometres an hour. On the left-hand side, there's a bit of a grass verge down there. And I remember thinking, why did Stephen slow up? You know, is there a truck on the track here or a crash or car or whatever? And it just and the backwards went on forever.
Waiting to hit something.
Waiting to hit something, right? Yeah. And my left-hand door was up against a concrete wall there, and that's ultimately where it stopped. And so I then and I'm watching in front of me now, back up the straight. By now, I was sitting there for ages. They're coming around behind the safety car. I remember cars were spearing off behind the safety car.
Yeah, I remember right? Who they were too.
Yeah, there you go. And they were trying to catch up the safety car and spearing off. It was horrendous. So I'm thinking, right, so I stay in the car here and die, or I open my driver's door and walk out onto the track and die. So my two options were die or die.
This is not a good option, either of these. This is not good.
So bad. So it was the weirdest bit of gymnastics I've ever did. In one foul swoop, I undone my belt, opened the door, up over the roof. It was
you went straight that way.
Up and over. I had to. Well, I couldn't open the left-hand door. It was just scary. So that was and then you remember the car we sold it to
Awesome. Well, yeah, that's right. So we've got to cover off the sort of the bit after because the deal before Bathurst 96 was announced that you were going to Stones for the following year. So because they had been pack leader racing with Alan Jones for 96, which that was the race that AJ's car went bang, caught on fire. And
can I just jump in? I tried so, so hard to get Ross Stone to come back to Sydney. To run my team.
Really? So before you went to them, you tried to get them to come to you?
I tried and tried. I wanted him to come and show us how to do it.
Yeah?
And you know, to this day, I have huge admiration for Ross and Jimmy. They're close personal friends. They are true racers. They knew touring car racing. And I just wanted Ross to come. I didn't want to leave my team. I didn't want to leave my guys. I love what we're doing. We had sponsorship in place. I just wanted Ross to pack up and bring his family down and come to Sydney. But I couldn't convince him, and that's why this is the reason I went up there.
So basically the opposite happened. You packed up.
I packed up.
So that meant all you guys out of a gig, or did you bring some with you, or how did that
work? No, pretty well I just walked into Stone Brothers, and it was kind of weird because I still had my own franchise. So I had my supercars franchise, but that functioned within the Stone Brothers organisation. And I mean, there's a whole other yarn there because that was the early days of another team couldn't do engine deals, so we had to put our engine contract to the board of Tiga at the time, and there was a lot of that sort of stuff, which was all the infancy of a lot of that stuff going on. So, so the car got sold, to Osborne, so I could just go and drive a Stone Brothers built car.
Yeah, so the Colour Scan privateer team, they were based up in Queensland. Danny Osborne was driving, his brother Jeff, they drove sports sedans and stuff like that over the journey up here. And they had originally gone into V8s in 97 with an ex-Tony Longhurst Falcon. So then they got another Falcon, which was your car. But your car sat out for 97. You go off to Stones and drive one of their cars, well, actually two of their cars, Phillip Island. You needed another one. And that your original car sat around for that year. It didn't compete in 97. It was benched. But it came back with the Colour Scan team in 98 because they ran two cars. And Brett Peters, who's still around the paddock these days, TCM cars nice and stuff guy. Like that, drove with Kevin Waldock in the Sierras and all that sort of stuff.
Another nice guy.
Yeah, he drove and the Colour Scan team raced it at Bathurst that year. White, red, blue livery.
Correct, yeah.
And that's the sort of colouring that it was in at the Adelaide 500 the following year, 1999, for that first ever sensational Adelaide 500.
It was there.
And it was there all right because
and so was Craig Lowndes.
Craig Lowndes was there. And they sort of went at the same – well, Craig got into the back of it. He didn't deliberately punt the guy off. It was a racing thing. But it was a heavy, heavy hit. The car smashed the wall. I mean, the vision of it is around and a lot of our listeners will have seen it. And she was rooted. Like, it was massive. Total write-off. Absolutely stuffed.
Do you know, I don't even know. Whatever happened to it?
From my memory, and we have covered this a little bit before on the website, but it's funny when you've written things so many years ago. I did speak to Danny Osmond about this car, and at one point it was donated to a TAFE, like it was stripped because it was pretty badly damaged. Yeah. And I presume somewhere in that, the parts that you've got now, you must have got somewhere along the way back then. I'm not sure how that all came to be, but it was sort of sent to a TAFE college up in Queensland as if a project, which I know you did with one of your other cars along the journey. And in the end, nothing really happened with it. I think it ended up getting cut up and it's right. No longer a thing. So it's a bit of RIP to the Mitre 10 EF of 95, 96. But you've kept that seat, the interior seat. What other bits are
I just kept around? It was literally as we pulled them off. We sort of just put them on shelves. So, and I just wanted to keep some because it was
So did you pull that out before you sold it?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah. So by the time Osboards were running, it was pretty heavily, you know, a standard type.
Normalised.
Normalised, let's call it normalised. Yeah, a lot of Harrop running gear in it, okay. Oh, yeah, a lot of that stuff was gone. So we'd already pulled. So, I kept some hubs, some wheel nuts, those anti-roll bars I spoke of, the seat. Just some little niceties just as a memories of what was an interesting, not successful, but just a life thing that happens and some lessons learnt and just a little reminder. So it's, I'm in many ways, I'm glad we did what we did because, I don't want to go to my grave sort of thinking, geez, I wonder if we'd gone and built an open wheeler inspired supercar, what would have happened? Well, we've done it and we know. And we're probably better off for the knowledge. Well, we are better off for the knowledge.
So there you have it, Mark Larkham on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. Bad news, episode over. Good news, part two next week. On part two, we cover a bit more ground. What sort of ground, I hear you ask? Well, I'm glad you asked. I can answer that question. Larko discusses his favourite V8 race car. We talk Oran Park 2000, that massive fireball crash with Paul Morris and what happened to that Mitre 10 Falcon. We talk about the metal grate incident from China that could have sliced Mark Winterbottom in half. He answers your National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions and how Peter Brock committed his time to help Larko's career in his younger days. Don't forget, every Tuesday, Castrol Motorsport News podcast with Stefan and AVL. We'll be back next Wednesday with another episode of the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. And every week, Thursdays, sometimes Fridays, Repco Supercars Weekly with all the latest news, notes and quotes from the Repco Supercars Championship. I hope you enjoy this chat with Larko. I love doing it. I love doing part two as well. That comes up next week. If you're listening to this down the track after it's been released, just go to it now. Part two with Larko. Roll on. I'll chat to you next time with another edition of the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Repco.